You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Family. I'm Colin from England.
And I'm James from London.
Which is in England, I think. And I'm Lou from Nebraska. And no, I don't get free healthcare.
Sore subject.
It's a sore subject. Yes. Yeah, those two boys over there go into the hospital because they're hurt, they're sick, they're injured, and they walk out with no bill. Me, on the other hand, one little tiny, tiny kidney stone, and I still owe over $1,300, so... No, I'm not bitter or anything like that.
We're going to pay before we go in, then.
Yeah, that's true, but we still pay for our taxes, too. So what's been happening lately with you guys besides hospital? James?
Oh, well, there's a bad thing to ask me. I've just spent the last week on holiday, and I got back last night at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I'm sorry.
After having had a two-hour delay trying to get back into the country through Eurotunnel because someone apparently fears foreigners. So don't get me started on this.
What do you think is going to happen when you actually come over here later this year? You know.
You'll be all right. Trump will sort them out.
That's what I was just going to say. Yeah, Trump will get you. He'll build a wall, and you're going to pay for it.
Oh, no. He said the other day he was going to nuke us.
He's going to nuke England?
Yeah, he said he wouldn't have any qualms about nuking England.
Wow. Well... Jerk. You're not, he's
probably
not nuking my friends.
Scotland turn his golf course down.
Jeez, he's not nuking my friends. If anything, James, you and I, let's stop by Trump Plaza in Las Vegas and boycott it, you know, picket it.
James would be the first to go. He's in London.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, he isn't president. Yeah, he can't take over till next year. So, you know, later this year, you and I will go out and say, don't nuke my land. Don't nuke my land. You don't live here, sir? I ain't saying nothing to you. Anyway. So here we are, season 4. Oh, I'm sorry. Colin, what about you? What's up with you lately?
Apart from answering emails from you lot. I've just been working, basically, enjoying Easter.
Yeah.
But I've been doing, you know, a few guest spots on a few podcasts, so that's been fun.
That's good. So, maybe someday you'll be able to repay us again.
You never know. You never know.
Just come over to Trekmate, okay?
If you'd watched Battlestar Galactica, you could have come on that one, but you haven't watched it.
Oh, no, I haven't.
So.
But, you know, come over to Trekmate.
Come over to Trekmate. Actually, I did ask James to come on Battlestar Galactica, but he was busy that week, so...
Holiday.
But hang on, I think I did say that by all means invite me again.
Yeah, but we do a block, you see, so we haven't got to do another one till next week. So if you're around next week, James, you're more than welcome.
Okay, I shouldn't ask to be invited when I know that I'm going to get an A in the neck, both from the wife and from Lou because next week is busy. So
yeah,
I'm generally happy to turn up to things, but I'll have to check my.
We'll sort something out off here.
Okay.
As they say.
Well, yeah. You know what you could do is maybe if Colin comes on for Suddenly Human, because unless I've screwed up again, I've got nobody for Suddenly Human.
When's and then, that?
That's next week at 9 o'clock. And then when we're done, you guys can do BSG.
That's like a 6-hour bender for us.
Oh, like you couldn't handle it. Like you wouldn't be hyped to do it. Now your wife might. Well, she'll be asleep before you ever get off.
She won't. She'll be packing his bag.
Yeah.
Suddenly Human is not a good episode, as far as I can remember.
No, it's
pretty sucky.
It is pretty sucky, which is why nobody wants it.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Anyway, if you find your pillow on the front porch, James, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cause it. So, me, on the other hand, it's been pretty busy here. My work suffered a very tiny fire. I mean, it was tiny. Ballast fell out of a light, caught a... that made no sense. I think James just said in code that maybe his pillow is already on the porch, because what he just said made no sense here. Oh, he must be coming
back. Hang on, Lou.
Yeah.
Sorry, Lou. You're talking about the stuff that just got sent over on text, right?
Yeah.
Because I've just received, from our conversation before, that was back and forth, I've just received like 9 messages from you guys.
Not for me.
I think that we've been on this temporal breakdown. So I think it's Skype acting up. I'm not actually sending you gibberish at this time.
Okay, must be. All right. Okay, so anyway, very small fire. Ballast fell out of a light, hit a pallet of flooring stuff, caused a little tiny fire. But unfortunately, that little tiny fire is pretty much destroyed millions of dollars of product, because the sprinklers went off, got everything wet, so the insurance is gutting everything inside, all product, and we're having to redo. So they're cleaning there's a fire restoration companies doing work inside the building, and because of that, we need security 24 hours a day. So it's going to be some overtime for Lou here, but don't worry, guys. I'll be here to record the show. Posting it, on the other hand, that may go back to Season 3 problems, but I'm going to do my best here. Okay, Season 4. I predict in Season 4, I could see quite a few fives, quite a few fours, a couple duds, brothers. What else? But the point is I'm looking forward to Season 4. What about you guys?
So what's wrong with Brothers? Are you saying Brothers is a dud?
It's a dud. Yeah.
No.
I think
Brothers is all right.
I think it's great.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the one with Law and Noonien Soong and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
anyway, sign it for that episode.
Yes.
We're gonna have words next week.
Yes, we are. Mark's going to enjoy this one. He'll be in the middle of us, too. You're wrong, James. No, I'm not. Anyway, we'll see. But here we're going to talk about family. Because as you know, family is everything. Family is the reason why we're recording this a week late. And as James said, tell everybody what you said about this episode so far.
But there's a part of me that thinks that this episode is cursed. Because yeah. Not only has it taken me out and Lou out, and then the fire hit, I don't think we've had the best preparation leading up to this episode.
No. So, but like you say, family was more important. So Cassia is fine.
Yes. Now, eventually, she's fine.
All right.
She just had a bit of an ear infection last week, as we were scheduled to record.
Okay. Yeah, and I ended up taking my daughter to the hospital. Turns out she's got a whole tummy full of stuff that just wasn't coming out. And so it caused a little infection, and she was in a little bit of pain. They thought she had an appendicitis. She did not. But they sure tested it like there was. So, yeah. So that big hospital bill that I told you about for my kidney stone, big hospital bill part two, the next generation is coming to us soon. All right. So, Colin, I know you're jacked for time, so why don't you, if you've got in the show notes, why don't you go ahead and go on.
Okay. The synopsis for tonight's show is Captain Picard takes leave on Earth and visits his family while recovering from his assimilation into the Borg. Worf's parents visit the Enterprise and help him deal with his discommendation. This is the second episode of Season 4 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is October the 1st, 1990. It was written by Ronald D. Moore, directed by Les Landau, and guest stars Jerry Kemp as Robert Picard, Samantha Eggert as Marie Picard, David Tristan Birkin as Rene Picard, Theodore Bukil as Sergei Rosenko, Georgia Brown as Helena Rosenko, Dennis Cregan as Louis, Doug Wirt as a holographic image of Jack Crusher, Colin Meaney as Miles Edward O'Brien, and Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan. There's a lot of guests in this one.
Go on.
So, what do you think about this show then, guys, if you can get away from all the health issues and we don't get any more jinxes?
I think we're heading on just fine, but what do you think first? You first, you're the guest.
I think we need to keep sending positive vibes out because everything's going okay at the moment.
Yeah.
I actually like this episode from personal because it's very much a character episode. We get to find backstories on Jean-Luc Picard. We get to meet Worf's parents. Miles gets a middle name. We also get to know a bit more about the ins and outs of Worf's upbringing. And we also find out that basically Patrick Stewart, well, Jean-Luc Picard, I should say, came from an Amish community. Because they don't even have a shuttle. He has to walk there.
Wow.
So it's like the Amish.
Yep, Colin, I was with you.
Okay. In what way?
There's no technology there, is there?
No. No, there don't need to be. He doesn't need it. Robert does not need all that new stuff.
No, he hates it. So, mind you, if his wife cooks as well as what it looks, then he doesn't even need a replicator.
Yeah. But how does he... How does he harvest his crops?
Well, actually, if you look at the long shot, you can see all the people working in the fields.
Holy crap. Okay, so they don't have money in the future. How does he pay the people?
Wine. Pays them with wine.
Wine.
Oh. Yeah.
Because it looks like he's always stuffing his face with grapes. Okay. Me, I like this episode. In fact, I love this episode. There's very little that I'm finding wrong with this. So I'm going to say straight out of the way, any problems that I might have or anything that I bring up that might sound negative, it's just pointing out things. It just has nothing to do with the fact that I don't love this episode. This is the reason I did something. My daughter was born on November 25th, 2001. And in my hand right now is about 10 to 15 pages of stuff that I have written for her that began on September 11th, 1 year after 9/11, 2002. This episode is the reason I did this. And the Jack Crusher stuff, it brings a tear every time. To this day, when I see this, this is where Wesley grows up. This is where Picard his wall is dropped. This is where we even find out what kind of hell Worf had to go through as a Klingon warrior on Goth. This episode is, as far as I'm concerned, perfect in almost every way. So let's talk about that.
So you're going to get this. This could be a 5 for you then.
Absolutely. 100%. James hates it when I actually give away a rating before. But yes, this to me is this. You know, we see a side of Picard that you never would have seen Captain Kirk do. You may have seen it in Janeway. Sisko. No. Sisko would be more crazed, I would say, than sad. Archer. Well, I'm sure Archer cries to his beagle all the time, but to have to break down here like this and realize what has happened to him. This is gold, okay. Am I wrong in any way, though?
I don't know. We ended what James thinks yet.
Oh, I thought he just ended it with he was with you.
No, I didn't say that. I do also. I think this episode is good. I think it's nice that it's here. It is a departure for Star Trek, in the sense that there's no kind of there's no stars and there's no very little Trek as well. But I think it's a good, you know, a good pause. I think my criticisms are going to be that I think that Robert is a tad too much of a caricature, and I think that the estranged relationship is slightly too plowed on, because you know, when you listen to the story, it sounds like Picard's not been home in 20 years, which is a bit, you know, I think it's a bit strange that now it's the turning point that he comes back, although it's, you know, I suppose, if not now, then when, I suppose. But I'm going to pick something up that you said, Lou, when you mentioned that Worf's background. I was rewatching this, and I have to say, I think that Worf's parents are the nicest parents in the world.
Oh my God, yes.
I think that relationship is just, you know, they do absolutely everything for this adoptive son of theirs. And I think that it's it's a relationship of pure love. And how they tried to encourage the dude. And I thought that was really, really sweet.
If you and I lived in the Rishenkos, I would think it would be wonderful. For a Klingon boy to live in the Rishenkos had to be hell.
But they were bending over backwards to make it, as Klingon-friendly as possible. They were trying their best to give him cultural awareness. And you could tell that they were trying to be respectful, yes. And even the fact of them actually turning up, right? That turning up in order to help Worf deal with the discommendation, which is mentioned, and how he shouldn't have to carry this thing alone. And although that's a kind of like a human facet, I suppose, of the relationship, I still nonetheless believe that it's appropriate for them to behave that way, and appropriate for Worf to let them in on this. I thought they were great.
Yeah,
she did. She did also make a point of saying that she learned to cook Klingon food for him.
That's sweet. Indeed. That's comfort food. That's very sweet. However, if you close your eyes, you're not going to ever vision Sergei grabbing his batleth and saying, "Let's meet out in the back, boy. Let's have a little fun." No, I think it had to be hell, because there was no way for him to get out aggressions. These people were just too friendly, too nice. She could learn to cook rock-cake blood pie, you know, but they never even bothered to learn how to eat it. What I'm saying is, you know, it had to be hell being the only Klingon in this colony, I suppose. His blood is starting to boil. He wants to get out and fight, but yet he's on this little farm here with these humans. I'm just saying, they are the best people I think I've ever seen in Star Trek, and I would live with them anytime. But for a Klingon who wants to be a warrior, that's why I say it had to be hell.
Yeah, I mean the dad mentions, I think it was the dad. One of the parents mentions that he did beat up 5 kids.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Which was like, you know, that's his Klingon side.
Right.
You know? and obviously they, he would have been, to a certain extent, he would have stood out, because you've got to think this is what his formative years would have been, 50 years after the Kitomer Accords. So that as there would have been a generation around that would have known about the Empire fighting the Federation. So there would have been that hanging in people's minds, and there's this Klingon, and oh my God, he's going to school with our children. What's he going to, you know, what's going to happen? And, you know, as much as they like to paint a utopian future in Star Trek, there is, people will have reservations.
Oh yeah, we get to see what amounts to Garak growing up on DS9 in a Bajoran world.
Yeah. So, you know, it's completely understandable that he would have had problems in his childhood. Yeah. You know, humans have problems in the childhood with other humans. So a Klingon on a human planet, he's going to have problems.
Right. Exactly. Okay. What do you guys think about McKinley Station? The claws all the way around the ship. That's a fairly interesting design, but...
It, to me, it just reminded me of like a dry dock. It's just something to hold it while they work on it.
But hold it for what reason?
Well, obviously, if you take the engines offline, its orbit's going to slowly start to decay if it's just sitting out on its own.
Hang, whoa.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Where's it going to drift to?
But I'm not going to pick that up. I do like the design of it. I seem to, you know, it's kind of like, I think it's a nice iconic design. I think they could have used, a few more changes, season 3 into season 4, in terms of cleaning up the bridge a bit more and maybe upgrading the ship, because they do explicitly have a reason to do so at this stage. And so I might have liked them to have, you know, to polish some of the corners and, well, you know, maybe give it a third nacelle or something like that, to make a complete shift from
third nacelle was very controversial there.
I know. I'm just poking the sleeping dragon on that one. but I know I like it. I think it's a nice, you know, nice design.
Don't you think the design is very of the time, though?
You mean 24th century?
No, I mean 80s philosophy. Because to me, the Sovereign class looks like a warship.
Right.
And because obviously it was built to fight the Borg, so it looks like a warship. Whereas the Galaxy class is more rounded. This more smooth contours. It's very much in the line of thinking like this is a family ship. It's gonna look nice. It's gonna look comfy. We've got counselors on board because everyone goes to see a counselor, you know, for absolutely everything. You know, we've got family areas. We've got schools. You know, it's very much, you know, a condominium in space.
Which is why we're horrified. What happens to the Galaxy class ship in DS9?
Yeah, when a Jem'Hadar take it out, just by ramming it.
You would think its shields would have been able to stop that.
There was lots of inconsistencies in space battle in DS9. It's like when they got the Defiance. The first time the Defiant comes into contact with the Jem'Hadar ship, it blows it away. The second time it comes into contact with the Jem'Hadar ship, it blows the Defiance away.
I love that part, you know. She's got flaws, but she's got teeth. And then that first episode, she went running to the dentist because several of her teeth got knocked out.
Yeah. It's there's a lot of inconsistencies with the space battles in DS9, but, you know, this ship can kick butt one week, but it can't kick butt the next week.
Right. Okay.
Though I will say one thing for the Defiance, it didn't get bored as much as any other ship in Star Trek.
But when it did.
is that because there's no room, though?
Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah. Was it that the Ferengi took over the Enterprise D, Khan took over Kirk's ship? I think absolutely everybody at some point took over Voyager.
K- Could you imagine Janeway's evaluation reports of Tuvok this year? Well, Mr. Tuvok, you sucked. Just want to say that. You're on report. You're on thin ice. Okay. Anyway, let's come back. McKinley Station. The ship is going a major overhaul and refit following the Borg incident. And Picard is, like, off in his own little world. And you can tell he is, he's beaten.
He's beaten, but I have to admit, I mean, the scenes with Counselor Troy, I thought she was pushing him a bit.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree. Troy winds me up in these scenes. I think it's pretty much the only scenes that she has, or she has this scene, and she also has a scene with Crusher a little later on. I don't think that, you know, the idea that Picard saying, hey, can I head back home? It's like, oh yeah, interesting.
Interesting.
Do you think that this might have anything to do with you being a complete wreck after having been abducted by the Borg captain? Eh? Eh?
Yeah.
And I would have told her to, you know, to shove it.
Okay, stop. I want to turn this around a second. Because obviously, you know, she is doing her job. But...
But you should.
Let's look at it another way. We don't like Troy in this scene. What if this was Guinan?
I don't think Guinan would have been like this because Guinan's people were assimilated.
Right.
You know, and she's basically, she's doing... She's doing like Freud.
But it had nothing to do...
She keeps saying interesting.
Yeah, right. But it has nothing to do with the Borg. This is about Picard and his well-being. But I'm saying...
But she also says at the start that, you know, what you've been through is going to take time to get over. And then she keeps pushing him.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got to get through this. But I'm just saying, do we have a possible Troy bias? Because what if Guinan was in there? You know, you're going to...
I don't think Guinan would have pushed him like that. Mm. I think she would have supported his decision to go home, and I think she would have been related to what he's been through more,
right,
because her people were assimilated. You know, that's scattered throughout the galaxy because of the Borg.
Right.
And I think my problems, by the way, with Troy in this isn't necessarily, you know, Troy here. It's that I think the writers think that they're being more clever at writing than I think they are. So the idea of Troy going interesting and then Picard saying, oh, I hate it when you do that. I mean, really? I mean, I don't think Troy's interesting is particularly telling, or I just think it's, you know, I think the person writing it thinks that being clever, but I just don't think that being clever.
Maybe,
and I don't think Picard's reaction is anything.
What about, it reminded me of Spock in TOS when he used to say fascinating. That's what it reminded me of. And I also think the kiss on the cheek was inappropriate.
Well, that's a workplace thing. Why beyond that?
Well, so you don't get a kiss on the cheek from your work colleagues when you go on holiday?
No.
I hope not. I work with a lot of men.
Yeah.
So, and some of them aren't that good looking, so no. No, I work with a lot of people. It's not just men. But I think it was because after pushing him for a good 5 minutes, she then says, have a nice time, and kicks him on the cheek. Like it was like a disarming move. You know, it was like she parried, and then fainted. And that's what it reminded me of. It's like she push, sidestep. And that's what the kiss to me was. She was like, well, I've been badgering you up until this point, and now I'm going to give you a release.
Huh.
You know, and at the end of the day, yes, you know, they are friends and work colleagues, but he's also the captain.
Wow. Hmm. Matter of fact, I would say the captain would be the hardest person she's ever going to get any real feeling out of. He's going to hide it all to the bitter end.
Yeah.
Now,
I don't think Beverly would like a kiss in him either.
Now, what you were saying earlier, James, about Robert, and I thought, I agree with you up to a certain point, but I think we are we were supposed to dislike him from the start. I think that's the way it was set up. And it worked. Three-fourths of the way, we totally disliked this guy. But then at the end, I completely understand him. I understand where he was coming from, and I understand why he was needed, why he had to be the way he was. It doesn't explain their estrangement from the past, but Picard, like he said, you needed it. This is what Jean-Luc needed, was for him to be the complete jerk he was, to draw him out.
Okay, sure, that's true, but he doesn't need to be as thickly piled on, right? He doesn't need to start going on about, Synthahole. He doesn't really need to start going on about the other stuff winding Picard up the way he does. And frankly, you can have an estranged relationship with your brother if you've not seen him for, 2 years. And it's just an uncomfortable relationship rather than it being a 20-year absence or something like that.
Right.
And I just felt that they made this dude too much of a caricature. And I think had he been slightly more rounded, he could have still been disagreeable. And I think it could have still worked. I just think it's a little bit too, broad strokes.
Can I just interject there?
Yeah.
My father died last year, as you two both know.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'd seen my brother for 18 years.
Wow.
And so, this 20-year thing to me, I didn't have a problem with it. Because I hadn't seen my brother for 18 years, and the only reason I seen my brother was because my dad died. And I haven't seen him since the funeral. So it's just gone back to how it was before. And that is sibling rivalry, because he doesn't like me. So if it's like someone gets a bee in the bonnet about someone, then, the longer the absence, the more it festers. And then you get to a point where there is no going back. And that happens in the families quite a lot.
Right.
And Robert just does say that he resented Patrick Stewart. He resented Jean-Luc getting the attention, getting the awards, getting the rosettes.
Right. But what would happen if your brother had a traumatic event and you clearly knew he needed help, he needed to get through this? But yet that estrangement is still there.
If he came to me for help, I would get him through it.
But he will. I mean, if you bring him into Jean-Luc's life, he does come to you, or he comes to the family. It's you and him. But yet you guys have built this wall that has to be broken down first. I mean, do you see anything that Robert was doing that was building up to, all the technology, that wretched technology? Eventually, it was enough. I think he knew what he was doing. He had to piss him off. He had to make him attack first so that wall will come down and what happened in the end would work. I think he knew exactly what he was doing from the moment he met him in the fields.
Yeah. But you can also see why some of them. I mean, this is Patrick Stewart's nephew, and this is the first time he's seen him.
Yes.
And the next, and he's not mentioned again until Generations.
Right. But whose fault is that?
Well, and that's the writers, isn't it? So,
It could be. But, I mean, let's assume that these people are real. That's Jean-Luc's fault. Earth has always been there. He has been back. Whether you hate someone or not, not meeting his son for 12 years, that was his fault. You blame the estrangement, but there's no reason why you can't come back and say, hello, I'm your uncle.
No, and they have been back to Earth.
Right.
So, it wouldn't have been hard for him to beam to France.
I find this, what I thought of this was Jean-Luc went through this torture and he realized what he wasted all those years being bitter and then decided to go back to family. But when he got there, you know, it seemed to me he put out his hand to Robert. He's the one that slapped it away for a reason and then just kept sniping him through the entire encounter until they finally, some very windy day, decided to have it out. And that's when the walls dropped. I don't know. I just feel like everything was done for a reason. We just didn't know what it was until the end.
Yeah, Robert definitely had a game plan. But, you know, being assimilated by the Borg made Picard aware of what he's passed up in his life.
Mm.
And again, this does come back in Generations, because when he learns, you know, spoiler alert, when he learns that they're dead, he actually says, Troy says to him, you didn't feel you needed to have children because Robert had done that. You know, and he actually says there'll be no more Picards.
Oh, yeah, that's got to be hell.
Yeah, so, you know, to him, I'm doing my thing and Robert's keeping the family line going. And it made him realize that why he's doing what he's doing, he's missing out on other things.
Yeah.
And I think being assimilated made him realize, you know, because, you know, basically assimilation is basically living death.
Yeah.
You know, you're trapped in your own body. It's as simple as that. What do you think, James?
Sorry, pardon me?
What do you think? Do you think Robert had a game plan from that, from 1 second?
I mean, to be honest with you, I don't think he had it all planned out from the beginning, but I think that there's enough of a relationship there. There's enough of a knowing what the other person is saying and how you read those in your family that I think he was able to guide it in that direction. So although I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea that as soon as he landed, Robert knew that he's going to have to, you know, confront Picard and stuff. But I think as their interactions went by, I think, you know, through what was said, what was not said, I think that they kind of naturally moved in that direction. And I think it's more that, you know, when you know someone very well, you can kind of pick up on these things rather than necessarily Robert knowing from day one that he needed it to be kind of, it to end in this particular manner. Now, I have to say as well, okay, let me get some nitpicks out, by the way. So Picard does mention that he had never met Marie before.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit weird. But then again, yeah, if you're estranged, then that's fine. I would assume that Picard's parents had died during the last 20 years. Maybe it was, you know, maybe the last time they did meet was at the funeral of one of their, you know, their mum or something. But it does seem like a very long gap. The other thing I was going to just point out, and it's strange that in the future, where there is really no, you don't have any pressures to have to go to work and earn money and stuff, I don't see why these people don't have more kids. So I don't know why it's that it looks like the bloke's in his 60s before he's considering kids.
Oh, yes.
He only has a son. Why not have? Hey, if not, money's no object and you're living on a field in France, have a bucket load.
Yeah. Well, he's in his 60s. She looks like she's in her 40s.
But that's just the way it works, right?
Yeah.
Well, we do know from the very, very first episode of TNG that, you know, Dr. McCoy's still around.
Yeah.
So we do know people in this timeline have, you know, in human terms, they've got to live to be at least 100.
Actually, I have to say, I think Robert Picard looks worse than the dude in the Survivors. So he looks about the same age as that guy. And I think back then it was like a 60-year-old or playing like an 80-year-old. So maybe we're expecting Robert Picard to be 80 himself. I still think it's too old to have kids.
Yeah.
Maybe he's too busy playing with his grapes.
Could be.
So to speak.
So to speak, yes. Insert euphemism here.
He had so many grapes, I was surprised. I'm shocked he doesn't have diarrhea every day.
I know.
But anyway. Okay, so Worf's parents are going to visit their little boy. But did you notice, I mean, I did not like the way he was treating them.
Can I just ask you two a question before we get into that, Lou?
Yeah.
Worf's dad said he had all the plans.
Specs and diagrams.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be classified?
Why? Well, yes, but he is a chief petty officer. There'd be information he would have access to.
Retired.
Yeah, yeah, he is retired.
So, you know, I don't know.
I mean,
unless Worf gave them to him. I mean, there may not be everything like the shield strength and stuff, but, you know, where the bathrooms are and where transporter is, yeah, he may have that.
I thought that, so the way I took it, by the way, it wasn't that he had detailed kind of like blueprints or proper plans. I was under the impression, I thought he was just like a fanboy that, you know, went to the bookshop and got those, you know, either the Enterprise pop-up books or, you know, the Enterprise, you know, the ones that show you the cut-throughs.
The Heinz manuals.
Various vessels.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that he basically said he'd been to Smith's and, you know, got as much Enterprise memorabilia as he could carry.
Or maybe it was an inline joke to the fans of all the specs and diagrams, because if you remember, TNG was the era of when those specs and diagrams did come out.
Yes. Yes.
Maybe it was an in joke.
Yeah, and that Heinz cutaway T-shirt was very popular at Star Trek London last time.
Never seen that. I don't know what that is.
Oh yes,
and I have to say, I have the Star Trek technical manual as well. So I don't know why Worf's dad wouldn't.
Well. Let's just hope the Romulans don't get a copy of your technical manual there, James. That would be the reason.
You won't want to check for cloak ships next time you back the car off the drive.
Actually, sorry, let me just pause for a second because... So I assume most people on... So Colin, did you ever have the Star Trek Encyclopedia?
Yes.
Okay, because I loved... I did get the Star Trek Encyclopedia probably around, I think it's end of, I think the first print came out end of season 6 on TNG. And then they updated it a couple of times throughout the Voyager run. And they never finished Voyager, as far as I remember. I think the last one was missing. I think it was missing Enterprise, it was missing Nemesis. And I was always very frustrated. And I don't know if everyone's aware, but they're actually reprinting they're adding to and reprinting the encyclopedia this year.
For the 50th anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's strange that in a day of Memory Alpha and stuff, that the encyclopedia is still this thing that I've really yearned for. But I am so looking forward to being able to take a physical copy of the Trek Encyclopedia that has got, you know, the entirety of, I suppose, what you might want to consider the prime universe. And the best thing is the JJ verse is there as well, but it's in an appendix.
Good, where it belongs. In the Excellent. Appendix. Right? Yes, we need to get an appendectomy. Okay. Okay, well, I think you had two questions, and I think I interrupted you. Did you get both questions, James?
Yes, I did.
Okay, good. So, back to Worf's parents. I thought they were absolutely hilarious. And I don't understand why O'Brien just wasn't laughing as soon as those doors shut. You know, something. Because remember when while they were waiting for their parents to show up, you know, I wish it was ending. Get, you know, beginning, end quicker. I understand what you mean. Unlikely. And then he tells them the story. I would love to have seen this scene extended. You know, your hair is a little longer, isn't it, Worf? Once those doors close, he would laugh and say, oh, these people are worse. You know, something of that nature. That would have been funny to me. But they are eccentric. You just take
That's part of the charm, though. The eccentricity is part of the charm.
Yes. I just take an instant liking to these people. The mother, she's just the absolute cutest. She is the cutest. And Sergei seems a little kind of weaselly, you know. He is very confident until someone says no. He goes, okay.
Oh, no, she's definitely the boss.
Yes. But...
Actually, maybe I'm going to put some... I have to put some cards, some personal cards on the table here, which is that... actually, I really like the Rodchenkos. I really like them, and I saw a lot of... I kind of saw a lot of people in my own family in them, and in particular, I happen to have Russian in-laws. I have a Sergei and Elena as a pair, as my wife's parents, and they fit this bill pretty tightly, I have to say. So I can't help but be smiling on the inside when I say it. I think that the accent is a little iffy, if truth be told. But overall, I really like this particular relationship and this dynamic, and in particular, the dynamic between the mum and the dad. It's, you see the mum rein in the dad and his enthusiasm, and I think it's very, very, very believable.
I mean no disrespect to anybody here, but they came off to me more as Jewish.
But...
Not so much Russian. Yes,
but actually, that technically is supposed to be Belarusian.
What's that?
I think they're supposed to be from Belarus.
Okay. Oh, Star Trek book. Okay. Your location may be different from the site you are trying to visit. Please select an option. I don't...
Ooh, you're breaking the fourth wall here.
I don't care. I do that a lot. Let's go United States here and see what the hell you guys are looking at.
Actually, it's interesting you shout out about the Jewish reference, because they weren't too sure on the casting of Picard's brother. Because the producers were concerned about the Jewish angle. I'm sure there's something about that.
From Russia?
I'm sure I read something about that when I was reading up about this episode.
Probably from Memory Alpha, I suppose. You know, that's funny. Okay, I'm going to break the fourth wall a little bit further. I could see that book in the UK form, but when I switch to US, it's gone. I don't see it anywhere. Bring me one, Doc, would you? I don't think it's here.
Oh, there it is. I found it. It's on Paramount Express. Initial concern over the casting of Theodore Bikel and Georgia Brown, feeling that the two, who are best known for working Yiddish theatre, would be too comedic or stereotypical for the parts. So that's basically saying what you said, Lou. So you had the same concerns that the producers had.
Well, that's cool. The Star Trek book. I'm sorry, I'm still looking down how I can get this.
Okay, Lou, I see that the book is released on the first of June. I will get you a copy of the book and I'll bring it to Vegas.
Thank you, because there is nothing here in the U.S. Oh, wait a minute. The Star Trek book, $25 pre-order form. Okay, I'll look into it.
Whoa, hang on. It's only £12 in English, so that's below the $25.
Yeah, that's like $16. So even let James get it. It works out cheaper.
Yeah, it would, actually.
Yeah, I'll only charge you $20 for it.
You got it. That's a $5 savings here. I could use all the savings I can in the hospital. Yeah,
you've got a medical bill to pay.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so... So now, like you said earlier, we know more about O'Brien. His middle name is Edward, and he's a chief petty officer. So why is he still wearing those lieutenant pips?
Well, his pips change during a lot during TNG. They change a lot. I think it's because he's a non-commissioned officer. So they wanted to do something different with the uniform, so they kept messing with the pips.
Uh-huh. Okay. Maybe he... Yeah, I guess. Maybe he's just like the substitute teacher in class. They send where he's needed. I don't know. I mean, why wouldn't they have an ensign in the transporter room?
Well, he's a chief.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, maybe that's his favorite transporter room, because they do have more than one.
And like you said, here's another thing. Why doesn't he call Wesley sir? Because in DS9, he made that crack. As soon as Nog graduates the academy, he's going to have to call him sir.
I think the difference was, though, that Wesley was a field commission.
Right. And we all know about field commissions.
Yes.
We already been through all that.
Well, and also it's Wesley, right? I mean, yeah. Really, there's also dignity involved.
There is a big dignity involved, but it's. I mean, I've mentioned this before, and you know, some people obviously listen to Lou's episode of How to Kill Wesley Crusher.
Yeah.
But for every episode where Wesley saves the ship in quotation mark, Wesley's also the person that puts the ship in danger in the first place.
Sometimes. But then again, so is Data.
Hang on, actually, I've got a couple of points here. Data's not in this episode, right?
No, he's the only one that's not in it.
Okay, so he's not in it. He's obviously being fixed. Wesley, in this episode, it proves that Picard is not Wesley's son.
No, it doesn't.
I think we should have It doesn't.
All it proves is Daddy did the recording for what he thought was his son.
Yeah, you need to say that again, because you just said Picard is not Wesley's son. And guys, I'm not taking that out. So that's too fun.
This episode proves that Wesley is not Picard's son.
You could try and change that all you want. That doesn't prove anything. That means no. Jack had no idea.
Yeah, okay, but it proves.
There are two things. First of all, Picard doesn't know because Picard's, you know, because the conversations on the planet. It's very clear that, you know, he is longing for, you know, making sure the family name continues, blah blah blah, et cetera, et cetera. And then the issue with Jack Crusher, he looks at the baby and he sees himself in the baby, and I think that I think on the grounds that the baby would probably have been bored at 12 weeks or whenever it was, if it at any point was going to look like Picard, it would have been just after the, you know, after the birth, before the hair came in.
You're a dad, James. You know that babies look, you know, at one day old, a baby looks nothing like anything.
No, Bradley looks like a baby.
Yeah,
it's got
all the baby fats. It's got all the, you know, all the excess bits and this, that, and the other. And there's excess skin on it. It's got excess skin on it that it's got to grow into, and there's folds all over it. You know, it looks like Patrick. You think it looks like Jean-Luc Picard?
It looks like Popeye. You know? It looks like Popeye. No, but I would be willing to think that maybe even Beverly never told him. And she certainly.
The only way to know is a DNA scan.
Yeah, there was never a DNA scan. Maybe there is. Maybe they do that in the future for all we know. But no. You know, and this whole thing, that proves not. And I can feel that you're my son. No, it's not. That means you've bonded with this, you know, little tiny human being. That's going to happen. If I brought home a...
It's going to bring up inconsistencies and all. The uniform she takes out of the storage box is not the uniform he's wearing in the hologram.
Right. But that's 6 months old. He was 6 months old. That's assuming that he died right then and there. And that's another question, and you raise an interesting question, because he said he wanted to do these more. He just never had a chance. I see both ways, because, again, I'm going to look at this page, these papers here that I've done. It started in 2002, but then for some reason I stopped, and Let me see, 2002. And I think I picked up like 3, 4, 5 years later. So in that time, you know, yeah, 3 years later, 2002 to 2005. So he says, you know, she says he wanted to do many more. He just didn't have the time. He could have died 6 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later. He just never had the time. But how old was he when he – how old was Wesley when he died? Was that really ever answered?
So I think that Wesley mentions that he remembers his dad. And in particular, actually, I think the way that it's phrased is he sometimes finds it hard to remember his dad. So that's with the, you know, as the passage of time is going, as he used to, you know his dad, and now he's kind of growing up and stuff, it's harder to remember. So I always took that as an indication that it was, and then my fear is that he might have been 10 or something like that.
Yeah, because he also makes a comment in another episode about he remembers when Captain Picard came to the house about his dad's death.
Oh, hang on. We have that scene though, right? In there's a episode of TNG where is it Violations? It's not Violations, but there's an episode of TNG where Picard comes back, and they have the scene played out where he's coming to deliver the news with
and he's got hair.
He's got hair,
and he has a little bit of hair.
He's got hair, but which goes completely Violations? Against Nemesis, where he doesn't have hair.
A lot of stuff goes against Nemesis.
Yes.
But the thing is yes, I know which one you're talking about, because not only did he have hair, Beverly had hair. But the thing is that you don't see Wesley playing in the background. Now, if you've seen him as a toddler in the playpen, maybe you'd get a frame reference. But I'm saying that uniform, that really doesn't mean a lot. He could have gotten promoted 2 days after he created that thing. The uniforms were changing, who knows, but yeah, and I'll give you a real life example, kind of sad, but when I was 8, I had a 12-year-old brother who died, and as time goes on, I find it harder and harder to remember what he was really like as a boy. So I can see where, you know, Wesley, it's getting harder and harder for him to remember his dad. I mean, I remember the trauma. I remember what we went through. And I even remember my next oldest brother started picking on me immediately because, you know, the other one protected me. And now he was no longer here. But
I think that's something that, you know, that particular thing is something that I really noticed to be true now that I'm older myself than when I was watching as a kid. And as you go through life, and as when you lose people in the family, you do progress, and you end up not necessarily remembering, but remembering the memory. And it is very, very, very harsh. And I think when Wesley mentioned that, and it wasn't in this episode, by the way, but in another episode, it completely chimes in my mind with like reality.
Oh, anyway, but you never know. As far as, you know, Brian Baker came up with an excellent thing about Wesley Picard, and he had rather elaborate discussion of where he came up with this idea, and it involved the Traveler, and it was just fascinating. And I'm gonna try and dig that out again, and maybe I could at least put it in the show notes if you guys want to talk about Wesley Picard. Okay, so let's talk about Renee. You know, I guess we could beat this dead horse, the fact that he lives in Le Bar, France, but yet has the deepest English accent you'll ever see on Star Trek.
And also bears an uncanny resemblance to Jean-Luc Picard as a child.
Very much so. Very much so, yes.
Yeah. I mean, the hair's slightly different, but, you know.
Little grown out.
Yeah.
He's my number one dad. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, I like that. I think that's fascinating that they use him in the future like that. I like his performance. Oh, God. I like Renee. I know a lot of people don't like child actors. Some I do. Naomi Wildman can't be beat. Others are terrible. But Renee is okay. Do you think the uncle line might have been a flub or a mistake that they just left in and not only left in, ran with? Or do you think Renee saying, "You're my uncle," it was written in?
No, I think that was written in.
You do?
Yeah.
Because it seemed like when he goes, "No, it's the other way around," he just kind of seemed confused to me, like, what just happened here? But I think you might be right, because during that initial meeting, it looked like, you know, the little boy was reading a lot of cue cards because he kept looking to the exact same location as he went on.
Yeah, no, I think that whole exchange was scripted, because he also does the arrogant son of a...
That was awesome. What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, I thought that... Yeah, let's talk about it later.
Yeah, and they never do.
No.
And I don't know, because if you go to France and you see some little boy calling his mom, he's not going to say, "Mummy, he's here." "Mummy, he's here!"
But that also, that exchange plays into what James says about the fact that Robert didn't have a game plan from the get-go, because he's clearly been bitching about his brother to his wife, and his son's overheard.
Right. Right. But then again, I think Robert probably has mellowed considering what his brother just went through. But when I say he knew exactly what he was doing, no, I don't think they were scripting. As soon as he walks in, I'm going to just ignore him completely. Then when he gets inside, I'm going to start bitching about technology. No, I don't think he had scripts on what he was going to do, and it just all evolved as it went along. But I think the buildup was there. He was going to draw him out one way or another to help him. And that's why I say he knew what he was doing as he went along. The past, what does it mean, arrogant son of... No, that was just bitterness in the past. No, yes, maybe. You guys are so quiet. I feel like I'm just talking a lot.
No, you're not. You're talking around. I'm giving James a chance to talk.
No, what... Yeah.
I was actually just looking up whether or not the village where Picard's supposed to come from, whether it was close enough to the English side of France, you know, whether it was in, you know, northern France, as to maybe it's that we kind of colonized. But actually, to be honest with you, it's a lot. It's basically next door to Switzerland, so we can't really even claim that that they speak English because they have a connection. Although I suppose in the 24th century, if you've got shuttles and if you have transporters, then it doesn't really matter.
I was thinking that too.
I always think that Earth in the future is the countries are kind of irrelevant, because it's a global government. Like you say, you can shuttle or transport anywhere you want. You've got universal translators. You know, so okay. You know. Hopefully, in the future, borders won't be such a thing.
I don't think it is now, because and the reason why I say this is, why do you two talk the way you do? Why do I talk the way I do?
Well, we talk the way we do because of the Romans and the Anglo-Saxons.
No, it goes more personal than that, because you lived in a house where the family talked the way you did, or the way they did. You grew up...
No, I don't live. My parents are Irish.
Really?
Yeah.
But I mean, as far as Renee...
I think a lot of it will come down to schooling, right? When you have people who are schooled, like boarding school or something like that, you'll send your kids away.
And we don't
If you send them abroad to learn.
Yeah,
most people don't. But it's very, it's very common to come back with the accent associated with the way you've been schooled.
If that's the case, but they're children that talk the way their parents do before they ever went to school, and You know, but
well, I mean, a prime example would be is if you go to Scotland.
Yes.
All right, and there's people who have settled in Scotland in the past 20 years, for argument's sake, from outside the UK, and their children have a Scottish accent.
Right.
So that, but their parents would have the native accent of their original country. But the children have a Scottish accent.
Yes.
It's because that's the environment that they're in. Most people speak with that accent.
Right. In other words, Kieran, our Kieran McDuff, Chris, he had no ability to change his accent to sound less Scottish than I do to sound like one of you two.
Yeah.
I can try to approximate you, but I could never have your accent. James has got, you know, I'm sorry, James, I know you don't want to hear this, but everybody knows the English accent is the most sexiest in the world. You know.
Well, I got accused of having a South African accent the other day.
But, I mean, you just take me and James. James is in London, I'm in Warwickshire.
Yeah, and it's different.
Know, it's different, and yes. It's a distance of basically 130 miles. So, I mean, to American, 130 miles is nothing.
No.
So.
Right. So I'm just saying that, you know, yes, they are living in France, but Rene has been living with this Englishman who, you know, obviously throughout generations married into a French family. Okay. But, yeah, so let's get on past that. Do you think Jean-Luc says you look exactly like Robert when he was your age? Ah, crap, that poor boy. I'm surprised he doesn't drop Picard's case and run into the house screaming into his room.
I'm going to end up looking like that.
Yes, exactly. What did you do, Jean-Luc? I don't know. We were just talking. He just... Is there something wrong with him? He just threw my case down and ran into the house. What's wrong, Rene? He said I was going to look like Papa. Oh, no. Anyway.
Poor guy's traumatized.
Yes, he is now. So the meeting of Jean-Luc and Robert, wasn't that heartwarming?
I think the Vine got more attention than anyone else.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. He could have kissed both sides of the cheek on the Vine, you know. At least get up and shake his hand. But no, you know, stuff your face with grapes. I'm not gonna cure this poor sick Vine. What did he say? See a short clip? Or click?
I think he just said, I've got to fix this poor sick Vine.
No, but right after that, it goes, see a short clip. Is it clip? Click?
No, click. No, he just said, I'll see you shortly.
Really? I thought he said, see a short clip.
No, he just said, I'll see you shortly.
James, what did you hear?
I have no memory that's going to resolve this either way.
Okay. I'll look for some audio file. And we'll let the forum decide. See a short clip. Okay. Okay, so this story, some Star Trek stories have an A plot, B plot. This actually has a C plot. Let's talk about it. First is Picard and his family. Picard and his woes. I'm surprised he isn't. And he was drinking a lot of wine while he was there. Second is Worf and his parents, and I'd say the third is the Crushers, right? Because she gets this box on Earth, and inside the box is a holographic message for Wesley. And like I said, every time I watch this, I like it. I love, you know, I'm jumping to the end during the holographic thing, and it did inspire me to create this. And I used a lot of quotes from this episode when I'm describing myself, and I even apologize for all the mistakes I was about to make, and it's just so cool.
So I hope one of those quotes isn't, he said, "Dear daughter, you arrogant son of a..."
I'll let her figure that one out on her own. And I also didn't say, I hope you don't resent the fact that I was gone so much of the time, because, you know, other than going to Las Vegas, and it looks like I'm going by myself this time, I haven't been gone so much of the time, but at least not as much as she would like me to be gone. But, so I like each storyline. I think they're all cool.
There is two interesting corresponding storylines in this as well. I mean, you know, despite the fact that the whole lot is about family. But there's also the interesting thing, because Worf's mum is obviously the peacekeeper in that family. And Robert's wife is the peacekeeper between Robert and Patrick and Jean-Luc Picard.
Right.
And the women in this episode are basically the moral compasses for the men.
Yes, I think you're right. That's a very good start with Deanna Troi.
Okay, exceptions to every rule.
Yeah, right. All right, so the Rozhenkos in engineering. Sergei wants to talk about the engines, well, sort of. He was a warp field specialist on the old Excelsior class. Remember that? The Excelsior class?
Yeah.
Didn't Enterprise we just... B. Huh?
Enterprise B.
Enterprise B. And you all have already heard this. Colin, you have not. That's another thing that's happening with me getting the search for Spock done. I've almost done with that. That was a pain in the... That was a long one to do. Almost done. But if you remember the old Excelsior class, the first one, remove a few bolts and you can actually just shut it down.
But it removed some components from the transwarp drive computer.
Bolts. He hands little bolts, you know, to McCoy.
But he did say he took them out of the computer.
Yeah.
So back your main, you know, you disable a computer in a car nowadays, it won't work. So, you know, that's not a stretch.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, in a car, you take out the fuse, just replace it with another fuse. But it took Captain Stiles just a wee bit long to get picked back up.
So, but it was actually nice to see Geordi not being a jerk.
Yeah. He was actually embarrassed for Worf, it looked to me.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, yeah, he wasn't barking at anyone and snapping at anyone and being the little dick that he is.
Yes. Yeah. And then there's the story. There was my boy standing by five teenage boys all with bloody noses. That's my best. I could do a Russian impersonation better than I can the English, I'll tell you that. Yeah, tell
me. Have you got any Russian listeners? Because if not, I'm sure they'll let you know.
Right, there you go. No. Yeah, put on the vodka. The vodka, and tell me what you think of our show. Sorry. Salute. S-A-L-U-T. I actually had to pull up the Netflix version and turn on the subtitles to say, because it sounded like they were saying, "Sale." And I thought, ha, got him. That sounds English. No, it's not. It's French. So, okay, so you're both now thinking, so what's he bringing that up for? Because if that's a French word, it confuses everything a little bit more as to why this English family now lives in France, but are using French words.
It doesn't though, because it's a, I mean, the word in particular is just a toast at the beginning of a meal, in the same way that had they said bon appetit, it would have technically been, you know, nominally a French word or a French phrase, but it's still mentioned or said by non-French people. So I think salut is something that is common enough that most people within like a French environment, even when they go like to a French restaurant, would be happy to say.
Okay. Here's another question. In France, I know in the UK, James, I think you talked to me about this. Hold on. You had told me one time that teenagers are allowed to go into pubs, and they can even drink at a certain age as long as they are with parents.
Yep.
So, what was Renee drinking?
Okay, within a traditional French family setting, Renee would have been drinking wine with a bit of water added, and that would be very normal.
Okay, because I tried to see what he may have been drinking, but I didn't really get it. So I didn't know if he was just drinking water or if it was he actually gave him some wine, so they would have watered it down for him.
Yeah, that's quite normal in French families.
Okay. All right. Sorry. What?
That wasn't me.
Yeah, it wasn't me either.
Well, no. That was my wife. She yelled out, "Sorry." Why? I didn't know the pizza pan was in the oven. I'm still not sure why she's sorry, though. Unless she must have dropped it. Oh, God, I hope she didn't burn herself. Okay, so... okay, father understood the dangers of losing those values which we hold most precious. And I was thinking to myself, that means father was an idiot. Because I think I'm with Jean-Luc all the way. You're fine. Hold your precious values, but there's nothing wrong with adding a convenience. Uh-oh. Did somebody just drop their microphone?
Yeah, that'd be mine.
Oh, okay. Father was an idiot. Any comments?
No, I think so as well. And I think the whenever you have these things, right, with people denouncing technology, I mean, unless they actually want to go back and live in a cave, what you always have is that they kind of always take on a view that this far and no further. So apparently having a shuttle into town is bad, or, you know, I assume they wouldn't be too happy to have Wi-Fi in their house. But having a house is perfectly reasonable, and having the technology around distilling the wine would be perfectly reasonable. Yes. So I always find this as romanticized nonsense, to be honest. I'm always in that kind of territory. Now, I'm sure that there are perfectly good reasons why people might want to choose an alternative way of living and an alternative way of preparing their wine. That's fine. Like, you know, an old-fashioned methods that keep it alive. But I don't see why you then have to take that as a crusade against, you know, the fact that you can have you have new methods of preparing food.
Right. But then there's some Alexises in the world, you know, DS9, the woman who's using technology to block all technology. That's some hypocritical crap there. And thank you, Upper Pylon 2 people, for pointing that out, because all these years I never really thought that. So, the storyline, Worf and his parents, and just like Robert is being to Jean-Luc, I couldn't understand why Worf was being such a jerk to his parents. And, I mean, he was even calling them out in front of other people.
He was protecting him from his shame.
He what?
He was protecting him from his shame. He actually said, "This is mine to bear."
Yeah.
But actually, I didn't think Worf was that bad. I honestly thought that Worf was... I thought that he was more kind of eye-rolly. on a lot of this stuff. So he knew his parents were like a, you know, a force of nature, right. And he wanted them to make sure they didn't disrupt or they didn't do stuff inappropriate. But away from that, I didn't think he was particularly particularly harsh, right? I mean, we've seen Troy kind of call out her mother and the relationship that they have. I thought Worf's interactions was really just like here we go again. Let me try to make sure that my family don't make too much of a fuss.
Yeah, I just the way Worf behaved to me was just he was just being Klingon. You know, and he was trying to protect. He was trying to protect them in a way and shield them from his discommendation,
okay.
By also trying to maintain his air of authority on the ship.
That I see. If the discommendation never occurred, are you saying he wouldn't have been like this?
Once he realizes that they're to support him because of his discommendation, he changes completely. You know, he even asked his mum to send him some pie.
Right.
So I think it's purely just down to the discommendation and the shame of discommendation in the eyes of a Klingon.
Okay. So,
what?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, once they had the heart of hearts, it changed.
Yes.
So, right. You know.
So Troy does a really bad job trying to counsel somebody, but Guinan, on the other hand, remarkable. Can you guys think of any scene that Guinan is in any episode that you don't like?
No.
Hang on. Who's the person that doesn't like Rascals? Because Guinan isn't in
Guinan
Rascals.
Guinan isn't in Rascals.
Guinan's in Rascals.
I really didn't care much for Rascals.
Yeah, she's in it at the start and at the end.
At the start and the end, but... Okay, but I mean...
She jumps on the bed.
Well, yeah. Okay. But what I'm saying is, when Guinan is doing her thing in her bar, or even out of her bar in the ready room, I can't think of a scene that I don't like Guinan in. When she's a serious Guinan. Rascals was meant to be fun, which is why they bring in the Ferengi. If they had any other race take over that ship, it wouldn't have been as fun as it was. They tried to make it serious, but there was nothing serious about Rascals at all. But Guinan in this scene with the Rajenkos, again, I thought she was awesome. You know, everybody stares at that window and they're looking at that little star they call home, and he's not looking toward the Klingon Empire, he's looking towards you. My God, that was some powerful stuff. And the music was perfect for it.
Yeah, Whoopi Goldberg is just a phenomenal actress.
Yeah, she's gone off the rails lately, but beyond that, as Guinan, I thought she has been wonderful.
Yeah. Well, that's the sign of a good actor or actress, that they are completely different when they're in the role.
Right. Absolutely. You know, so anyway, do you think Troy might have went to Angel Falls by herself? You know, Will and I have been thinking about going to Angel Falls. Well, Will never went because he's still on the ship and wants the results of the phaser test. You think she's pissed?
I don't know. I mean, Riker doesn't really feature in this episode.
No.
Data, obviously established, isn't in it.
No.
Beverly's in it, but not much. So, no, maybe she went somewhere with Will.
But Will never left. He's still on board, unless he called by subspace to get the phaser test results from Angel Falls.
Well, he could have done.
And he could have done that. She's still angry because she's in the hotel room, and he's on the comm channel to Worf. Who knows? Let's talk about this new Atlantis. Go ahead.
It doesn't take much to beam down. It doesn't take long to beam down. They could have beamed down, had lunch, and then beamed back up.
Or, in Will's case, beam down, get a poke, beam back up. She's still laying in bed in the afterglow. He's already back on the bridge. You both are stunned at that one. Yes, yes, us Americans, we are idiots, aren't we?
Those younger viewers listening, a pokey's a type of sandwich.
God. Back on Earth, let's talk about that new Atlantis development project.
Well, this is basically a plot device used to underline how he's reevaluating himself after the Borg, and how he says he was tempted briefly, but he could never leave Starfleet in the end, and he knows that in the end it's all about, you know, his assimilation, how it's affected him, how it's, you know, how he's considering his life and his future. That purely the Atlantis thing is all about that.
Right, because
and I think it works. Sorry, and I think it works well from the plot perspective, because something that Robert brings up is that, hey, you've been a hero, you then come back to Earth, you then do this project, and it doesn't at no point is there a suggestion that he is, you know, quitting or giving up,
I take the exception to that, because when you go on vacation, or you call it holiday, and you're about to leave the house, do you ever turn around and look at it like, I could miss this someday, or I may miss this? And that's what Picard does. As soon as, just before he walks out of his quarters, he turns around and kind of takes in his quarters. And that there told me, there's a possibility that he may not be coming back.
No, sure. I mean, what I was talking about is that from a public, if you have a public perception issue and you have been in the public phase, I think the idea of him having this project to fall back on, he can take this and not lose face. He doesn't have to resign and spin out and there'll be questions about exactly what he's doing now. I think it is a very nice transition that he could have taken. And I do think it's a good plot device to keep, to raise this from the captain's perspective.
Okay. Well, let's push on and let's try and get this done soon, because Colin needs to go. So the only thing I was thinking of real quick is, what are they trying to do in the Atlantis development project? Are they trying to drop dirt in the middle of the ocean and create a new continent?
I'll leave that to James to answer, because he's a scientist.
School us, James. School us.
No, I didn't actually quite get it. I didn't know whether or not I didn't understand whether or not they were trying to raise something up from the floor bed as a new continent, or whether they wanted people to live on the floor bed under the sea. Because it sounded like they were going to raise it from the floor bed to begin with, but then Robert mentioned, "Oh, we don't need another continent under the sea." So I actually was none the wiser.
Okay.
But it's not integral to the plot.
No. No, it was a device to for Jean-Luc to consider leaving Starfleet and joining. Okay. Now, then there was a mental image of the Rozhenkos tucking in Worf. That would have been cute. And let's talk about the fight. What was the deal with the gale force winds that picked up during the fight?
Yeah, I did notice that. For some reason, while they was fighting, it got windy.
Right.
And then after they finished fighting, the wind stopped.
It stopped. I thought that was Father trying to stop it.
Maybe.
Yes. And then during the fight, that poor vine. I mean, that they clobbered that poor vine during the fight. Knocked it all down.
Yeah, that's another one for him to fix.
Yes. Other than that, it was basically two old farts fighting, which really did not amount to much.
They basically just pushed each other around.
Yes, and threw dirt at each other.
But
it was a pivotal moment between the two.
Yeah, that's when Picard broke.
Yes, and that was fun. The music during the fight didn't fit it at all. I didn't like it at all. After then it stopped, and then, you know, you were, as soon as we get the "you don't know, Robert, you don't know," that's when the music comes back, and then it was pretty sweet, pretty perfect.
But also for two people who are apparently French,
yeah,
they don't know one of the most well-known French songs, because they basically sang the same two lines.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so we have that, you know, she comes walking in, finds her house half destroyed, her mud all over, and it's good you got to tell your system. Perhaps it was, Marie. And he's going to go back to the Enterprise because, well, you know, that's just where he belongs. And I like that moment, too. But if I ever doubt myself again, you know, he knows where to come. And that's why I say Robert did job well done. That was the whole purpose. Or else he would have kept encouraging him to get away from all that technology. His whole purpose was to get him back on that ship. Because that's where he belongs. I don't know.
I would like to just say one thing about the ending now. Why didn't he just beam back up?
Yeah. He wanted the exit. Why didn't he just beam in? He could have beamed right to the front door. But he, you know, not only that, he didn't even take the shuttle in. He walked. Why, right, like you said, the thing is, the ship is in orbit. Why doesn't he just beam down to the door? I'm sure O'Brien could have figured out how to get him there. Load program Crusher 1. And again, I cannot stop harping on this. This is the most, one of the most beautiful scenes in pretty much a lot of Star Trek. I like it. And this is where Wesley grows up. What do you think about the actor playing Jack?
Well, it wasn't really a stretch, was it? He basically did a monologue.
Right. But it looked to me he was looking Wesley in the eyes. And maybe that's just where the program took his eyes, because how would he have known he was that tall? He's talking to the baby, the 6-week-old baby. He would normally be looking down in the crib, but in this case, he was looking Wesley in the eye. But still, I like the guy playing Jack. You know, we'll see him once again. I'll leave it at that. James, were you going to say something?
No, I was going to be facetious for a second, but I don't think it's appropriate to butt in.
Well, that wouldn't have been fun. That's not fun. Come on. You don't ever get facetious.
The only thing I was going to say is that maybe it's like the Mona Lisa, where the hologram effectively appears that it's following you around the room.
Yeah. Yeah. But at one time, I thought he actually circled around the hologram. But, nah, we didn't see that. But I do like the part where he goes, tries to go up and touch him on the arm, and he disappears. That was pretty obvious, you know. He was never here to begin with, but he is gone.
Actually, I think the only problem that I have with this particular scene is that Wesley doesn't completely break down, because I know that I would.
Not really, because, you know, if I had a holographic image of my dad talking to me when I was 6 weeks old, it would be very cute. I don't necessarily know if I would just cry and break down, especially since he's been gone so long. Anything on that? Okay. You guys still there?
Yeah. Okay. I've got nothing to say about it. So.
Okay, cool. Okay, then it's time to say goodbye. And I like the two men in the goodbye scene. I thought it had pretty genuine feeling. The hurt on Robert's face during the hug. And, you know, back to the stoicism after the hug. Again, I think it lends more credence to my feeling of, you know, he's tough, he's brusque, he's mean. He gets in that hug, and then he's got that little girl, sad puppy dog face, and, you know, Jean-Luc is leaving again. Pulls out of that hug and back to where he was before. So I kind of like that. I thought it was cute. And once again, Sergei Rodchenko has all the specs and diagrams at home. So let's end this one with the final scene. Rene is staring at the stars. It's getting late, but let him dream. Sweet! I just love that part too.
Apart from the fact Orion's belt is wrong.
Oh, see, that's another thing. Was that a shooting star, James, or was that the Enterprise leaving orbit? They can't warp out of orbit. They're not supposed to warp in the solar system. So what was that at the very end?
Oh, I was interpreted as being a fallen star.
Ah, because he missed it. I mean, he was looking in the wrong direction.
Actually, for the first time ever, I noticed that he's supposed to be... I mean, he's supposed to be awake, right?
Yeah.
I always took from it that Rene had fallen asleep underneath the tree.
No.
And it's only...
Go on.
When I was watching the Blu-ray editions that I actually realized that he was actually awake.
Yeah. No, I always took it he was... I thought he was going to, you know, somehow... He knew exactly where the ship was in orbit and wanted to see if he could spot it. Then it's time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. I had read somewhere, and I'm not exactly sure if it was on Memory Alpha or where, but in preparation for this episode, I had read that Gene Roddenberry didn't like it. I don't know why. Agreed, there's no action. There's no aliens, except for Worf. There's nothing of the traditional Star Trek in this. We don't even see the bridge. There's nothing traditional Star Trek, but I love it. I love it. I still maintain this is part 3 of a 3-story arc. Colin, you didn't get a chance to talk on that. What do you think? Is this its own episode, or is this part 3?
No, it's part 3.
Okay.
You know, even Brannon Braga says in interviews that, you know, a lot of the staff consider it part 3. Les Landau considered it part 3. So, you know, a lot of people see it as part 3.
Even though they filmed 2 episodes before this.
Yeah, well, that's normal in TV. They film all over the place.
Wow, did you just notice?
It's mainly because of the location. It's mainly because of the fact that they're filming on location, that there were 2 episodes done before, rather than anything else.
Right.
Yeah. But it is quite normal in TV to film out of sequence anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, the aftermath of the first previous episodes, I love this. This is cool. I like these kind of heartfelt stories, and this one delivers. Everyone finds some kind of healing here. Sure, Picard's not healed by any stretch of the imagination, but he's getting there. This is what he needed to begin healing. He couldn't turn to Troy. I don't think Troy is even appropriate at this juncture to help him. I think he, if anything, he should have gotten an outside counselor to assist him. He needed somebody to break down this wall, and Robert was a perfect person. So although he comes off as an ass, he knew exactly what he was doing, I think, and why it had to be done this way. I kind of like the character of Renee, and I certainly love Marie. She is very charming. How she puts up with that crotchety old fart, I just don't know. But obviously, he's different when he's with her. But they're an interesting couple. The Rodchenkos, oh, they're absolutely charming. They're sweet. Sergei seems to just be so excited to be on the ship and to sort of be back in action again, but not really, you know. They seem like the perfect parents, as Guinan points out. She was there at the right moment and had the most heartfelt dialogue. The holodeck program, as I said, was inspiring. I'm using that. I've used it. I'm still, to this day, writing a little something to her. And when she turns 18, she's going to get it. I don't think she even knows that. I don't think Alexa knows I've been doing this. So, anyway, it's perfect. Everything about this episode is great for me. And I'm giving this a 5. I think the Great Bird of the Galaxy was wrong. I think Gene Roddenberry is wrong. I think this is one of the best Star Trek episodes that isn't really Trekkie. So it's a 5, total 5. Colin, what about you? Since you got to go soon, why don't you give yours up?
Yeah, I like it. I think it's a 4. I don't think it's a 5. I think it's a 4. Like I said at the start, it's got some great character moments. It ties in perfectly with The Best of Both Worlds Part 1 and 2, showing Picard's pain and anguish, which we come back and see in First Contact. It also lays the seeds for things that we see in Generations. So, you know, this episode is pivotal for the rest of TNG, basically, in what it lays down. And it's also nice to see where the characters came from. So, yeah. What about you, James?
Okay, I kind of have to agree. I think this episode is a very good episode. I do like it. I think it's a lot of decent, very good character development, certainly on the Picard and also on the Worf side. The stuff that they throw in there with Wesley is also like very well fitting, although I suppose they could have had that as an E-plot or something else. So I mainly take the A-plot as being the Picard and Worf axis. It's not a very Star Trek-y episode. It is dealing with the fallout from the previous two-parter, Best of Both Worlds, with kind of the extremely large emotional kind of hit that Picard took, and then also previously I thought they did very well to pick up the thread from Worf and his discommendation. I think it worked very well in this episode.
What is going on?
Sorry, is that from you?
No, that's Colin. Colin, it's like are you on a notebook or something? Because it's like your microphone switches to the background one, then to your forefront one.
No, I think Colin is physically being beaten up at the moment.
No, I'm not being beaten up.
So now you're echoing like you're on a notebook microphone.
Oh, hang on. I know what he's doing to this.
I have no idea what he said.
He's muted himself. So anyway, okay. I think that I really do like this episode. I think it's hard for me to give it a score. I think that there's a few things that just don't quite push it out into like 5 out of 5 territory for me. I don't know whether that's potentially kind of like a stage of life issue for me at the moment, or that I'm just not quite personally connecting to some of the story here. I can certainly respect it as a very good and very very well done episode. So as a result, I kind of, I do respect this episode. It's not in my mind up there as 5 out of 5. So for me, it comes in at a 4 out of 5, but a great episode nonetheless.
Okay. All right. 4 out of 5. That's good. Then so far I'm beating everybody in my rating. So I'm 5 out of 5. Okay. So, and James, you're 4.5, and our guests are 4.5. Okay, good enough. Colin, thank you very much for coming on. Let's see where I have you. I have you for Data's Day, somewhere in June.
And, yes.
Good.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation, Commander Data's out of control.
He's gone far enough, Data.
Lives are in danger.
We cannot even call for help.
He's being controlled by a mysterious scientist.
This is why I've brought you here, Data.
And comes face to face with an evil brother. Deadly reunion on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
All right, thank you again. And join us next week as we review Season 4, Episode 3, Brothers. So take care, everyone, and good night.
Good night.
Good night. Okay, thanks, Colin.